Have you ever found yourself face-to-face with a rhesus macaque monkey while cramming for exams? Sanjay Sarma did. Despite ranking among India's top 500 students and earning admission to the prestigious Indian Institute of Technology, he soon found himself failing courses and questioning his intelligence. That monkey, freely taking what it wanted, while Sarma struggled to absorb knowledge, seemed better adapted to university life than he was. This pivotal moment sparked a lifelong quest to understand why traditional education works for some but fails so many others. GRASP has become a sensation among educators and learning enthusiasts, with figures from Elon Musk to Bill Gates praising its revolutionary approach. The book sits at the intersection of neuroscience, psychology, and education, offering a compelling case that our learning difficulties often stem not from personal deficiencies, but from educational systems designed without considering how our brains actually work. As Sarma and co-author Luke Yoquinto take us from sea slug neurons to MIT robotics competitions, they reveal that learning isn't supposed to be painful. It's our evolutionary birthright. Our educational systems don't shape students so much as systematically eliminate those who don't fit predetermined standards. Like a winnowing device separating grain from chaff, schools filter out deviations through testing methods, teaching approaches, and access barriers including geography, cost, and social position. Despite college tuition increasing at twice the rate of inflation since the 1980s, degrees remain financially worthwhile investments, yielding median lifetime benefits of roughly $500,000. However, this creates a stark correlation between family income and college attendance. Only 25% of lowest income students attend college, compared to 95% at the highest income levels. The concept of educational selectivity rests on troubling assumptions about intelligence being fixed and knowable from an early age. While Alfred Binet designed intelligence tests to identify students needing intervention, others co-opted these tests to support scientific racism. By the 1930s, schools routinely used IQ tests to sort children into tracks, with Stanford psychologist Lewis Terman insisting a child's educational limits could be predicted in their first year. This approach persists despite evidence that intelligence isn't fixed, but highly responsive to environment, affected by pollution, nutrition, stress, sleep, abuse, and education itself. Each additional year of schooling yields 2.7 to 4.5 IQ points on average, demonstrating intelligence's malleability. Early 20th century psychologist E.L. Thorndike's experimental approach shaped education by reducing learning to mental associations. When actions lead to desirable outcomes, they're likely to be repeated. This provided scientific rationale for standardizing schools, while assuming some students were inherently better at absorbing information than others. Thorndike, collaborating with Terman, believed this capacity was genetically determined and fixed for life, fueling the obsession with testing and sorting students. While education structures crystallized around Thorndike's views, cognitive science advanced, revealing his theory as an oversimplification. The pervasive notion that learning should be difficult became perhaps the most obvious impediment to making learning accessible. At MIT, this manifests in the infamous IHTFP initialism, I hate this fucking place, and the fire hose metaphor, a point of masochistic pride, suggesting that learning involves gulping down information at high pressure. Despite widespread advice to space out studying, many students persist in last-minute cramming. Research consistently shows that spaced learning, studying in sessions separated by days or weeks, is dramatically more effective than studying all at once. This spacing effect works across diverse learning contexts: language acquisition, 34% better Swahili vocabulary retention; mathematics, twice the performance after 4 weeks; and even motor skills like surgery and golf. Most remarkably, it extends beyond humans to mammals, fruit flies, and even brainless sea slugs like Aplysia, with just 18,000 neurons compared to humans' 86 billion. Erich Kandel, who fled Nazi Austria as a child, sought a simpler model than the complex mammalian brain to study memory formation. He turned to the sea slug aplasia, with its giant identifiable neurons and simple behavioral circuits. Working with isolated neural clusters, Kandel replicated three fundamental learning types: habituation, diminishing response to constant stimuli; sensitization, heightened response to noxious stimuli; and classical conditioning, pairing significant and neutral stimuli. Kandel's breakthrough came when he confirmed that behavioral changes matched synaptic changes perfectly. Sensitization strengthened synapses, while habituation weakened them. Classical conditioning created new neural connections between previously unrelated sensory cells and motor neurons. These findings settled long-standing controversies, showing that while neural circuits are pre-programmed, experience determines how signals flow through them. The spacing effect, once considered peripheral, proved central to memory formation at the cellular level. In 1971, Kandel's team discovered that stimulating an aplasia siphon 40 times consecutively produced one-day habituation, but spacing the same stimuli over 4 days created habituation lasting weeks. Long-term memory required protein synthesis and structural changes. Synaptic spines grow larger, add receptors, and even form entirely new connections, physically altering brain structure. Evidence supports long-term potentiation, LTP, as memory's mechanism. It forms quickly, persists long-term, and weakens in animals with diminished learning capacity. Most tellingly, LTP follows the spacing effect. Spaced stimulation intensifies its effects by allowing cellular machinery to refresh between encoding attempts. This suggests the spacing effect isn't just a learning quirk, but a fundamental feature of memory formation, perhaps evolved because repeatedly encountered information is typically more survival critical. Cognitive science exists as a stack of disciplines with knowledge gaps between them. At the bottom lies genetics, followed by cellular neuroscience, then systems neuroscience, using tools like fMRI, and finally, psychological, sociological, and economic inquiry at higher levels. Scientists work both upward and downward to connect these levels, with phenomena like the spacing effect notable for spanning multiple levels of explanation. Recent systems-level neuroscience has elevated the concept of a highly compartmentalized brain. John Gabrielli, a researcher at MIT's McGovern Institute, has focused both on specific neurological disorders and fundamental questions about memory and learning mechanisms. His work with amnesic patient Henry Mollison, HM, helped revolutionize our understanding of memory systems, revealing distinctions between explicit memory, conscious recollections, and implicit memory, unconscious skills and conditioning. Meanwhile, his colleague Nancy Kanwisher discovered the fusiform face area, pioneering functional mapping of brain regions and revealing the brain's highly specialized perceptual systems, including the visual word form area that processes written language despite having no evolutionary precedent. By the late 1990s, Gabrielli had shifted from memory research to reading processes, leveraging new brain imaging techniques to trace the neural pathways of reading. When reading a word like peanut, visual information travels first through basic processing before reaching the brain's letterbox, visual word form area, which identifies letters regardless of font or case. From there, information follows either the deep root, directly connecting letters to meaning, or the surface root, connecting letters to sounds before accessing meaning. Dyslexia, affecting 5 to 12% of children, often involves atypical development of the white matter pathways connecting language centers, particularly the left arcuate fasciculus, crucial for phonological awareness. This disrupts the surface reading route that's essential for sounding out unfamiliar words. Reading is not an evolved ability, but rather a hack of our neural equipment that pushes brain architecture to its limits, making it vulnerable to even small disruptions. What triggers curiosity in the brain? Columbia neuroscientist Jacqueline Gottlieb offers a learning progress theory, suggesting curiosity is triggered when we encounter information that forces us to change or reframe our prior knowledge. This explains why classrooms require strategic approaches to foster curiosity. The Socratic method has endured for millennia precisely because questions create digestible information gaps that make learning as satisfying as eating or drinking. By the late 1950s, behaviorism began giving way to the cognitive revolution, which examined the inner workings of thought. Jean Piaget, who began his career studying mollusks before shifting to psychology, became influential in this movement. While standardizing intelligence tests for children, Piaget went beyond simply recording wrong answers and began asking follow-up questions to understand children's reasoning processes. Piaget discovered that children make similar mistakes at similar ages, suggesting discrete developmental stages. His fundamental insight was viewing learning not as passive data storage, but as active creation, the building of personal mental models or schemata about how the world works. This theory explained both fundamental rule learning and selective attention in memory formation. The 1957 Sputnik launch transformed American education priorities. MIT physicist Gerald Zacharias hired Harvard psychologist Jerome Bruner, a Piaget enthusiast skeptical of behaviorism. Their 1959 Woods Hole Conference on Applying Cognitive Science to Education led to Bruner's influential book, The Process of Education, which helped establish Cambridge, Massachusetts as the epicenter of the cognitive revolution. Piaget's ideas entered MIT directly through Seymour Papert, who had worked with Piaget in Paris. Papert developed Logo, a simplified coding language for children, and the Logo turtle robot that drew geometric designs on paper. His philosophy, called constructionism, held that knowledge construction happens most effectively when learners build tangible objects in the world. Mitchell Riznick, Papert's student, now leads MIT's lifelong kindergarten group and developed Scratch, a visual programming language with nearly 30 million users. While constructionism injects much-needed motivation and context into education, a growing camp of researchers argues these strategies may actually impede learning. Sanjoy Mahajan exemplifies this inside-out perspective, contending that well-intentioned outside-in reformers are systematically obstructing learning. The failed whole language movement of the 1980s serves as evidence. This approach taught reading through word memorization rather than phonics, assuming children would naturally map written words to meanings. By 1996, California's full adoption of whole language had made it the worst performing state in reading tests. John Sweller's 1985 study delivered another blow to discovery learning. Students who studied worked examples outperformed those who practiced solving algebra problems themselves. Similar results appeared across mathematics, statistics, geometry, and programming. Working memory's limitations explain why problem solving can impede learning. George Miller's pioneering research found most people can maintain about 7 chunks of information in working memory, though later studies reduced this to 4. While Thorndike's law of effect, how memories are stored in associative webs, received considerable attention, his law of exercise, concerning forgetting, was largely neglected. Psychologist John Alexander McGeoch's 1932 experiments revealed that forgetting is more complex than simple memory decay. When subjects memorized word pairs like cat-peanut and were later exposed to competing pairs like cat-glasses, remembering the original pairs became significantly harder than time-based decay would predict. McGeoch reframed forgetting as interference rather than erasure, suggesting memories remain intact but become inaccessible. This distinction led Robert and Elizabeth Bjork to develop the concepts of retrieval strength, how accessible a memory is, and storage strength, how well learned something is. Robert Bjork's mathematical psychology research unexpectedly revealed that forgetting might be essential to learning. His computer models of memory only functioned properly when short-term memory units engaged in random forgetting, allowing information to transfer into long-term storage. the Bjorks revolutionized memory theory by proposing that long-term memory might be effectively limitless. Rather than seeing forgetting as decay from limited capacity, they reconceptualized it as an adaptive tool for pruning our knowledge tree. When retrieval strength is high, practicing adds little storage strength. But when retrieval becomes difficult through forgetting, successfully recalling information significantly increases storage strength. This explains why effortful retrieval is so powerful for learning. The struggle itself strengthens memory pathways while weakening competing associations. As the new theory of disuse gained traction, educators began applying its principles across learning domains. Studies showed interleaved practice, varying activities rather than blocking similar ones together, forces reloading of mental programs, creating effortful retrieval that builds stronger skills. In classrooms, pre-testing emerged as powerful. Taking practice tests before final exams significantly improves performance, even activating knowledge related to incorrect answers. Robert Bjork coined the term desirable difficulties for techniques that both challenged metacognitive illusions and strengthened memory storage. Spacing, instead of massing, made the list, neutralizing false security from recently learned facts while allowing retrieval strength to subside so storage strength could increase. Interleaving created even more desirable difficulty, with greater forgetting and better transfer between disciplines. Florida International University School of Law provides a powerful case study in applying desirable difficulties. When Louis Schulze became head of academic support, he implemented a program teaching students how to learn using techniques like self-pretesting, spaced repetition, and metacognition. Within 2 years, FIU rocketed from 9th to 1st place in Florida bar exam passage rates. Most inspiring was the program's impact on struggling students in the bottom 20% of their class, whose pass rates jumped from the high 50s to the low 80s. MIT's Technology-Enabled Active Learning, TEAL, classroom revolutionized physics education by eliminating the traditional front-back orientation. In this 3,000-square-foot space, the professor stands center while students work in groups of three at 13 tables, equipped with networked laptops, whiteboards, and visualization tools. Each table features multiple displays showing simulations, problem sets, and real-time experimental data. The breakthrough came when data proved TEAL students answered conceptual questions twice as well as lecture students, with half the failure rate. Most significantly, TEAL eliminated the gender performance gap in physics, particularly benefiting women who had historically been disadvantaged by traditional gatekeeper teaching approaches. The collaborative environment encouraged peer learning, immediate feedback, and hands-on experimentation that helped students grasp complex physical concepts through direct experience rather than abstract lecture. Despite TEAL's success, one wonders what might be possible without its inherent limitations of time centrism, administrative constraints, and prohibitive costs. The search for alternative models leads us back to 1787, when Reverend Dr. Andrew Bell arrived in Madras, now Chennai, India, and established the Male Orphan Asylum. His educational breakthrough came after observing an Indian vernacular school where older children taught younger ones to write by tracing figures in sand. Intrigued by this organic peer teaching system, Bell organized his school into flexible classes where students moved based on their individual progress, advancing when ready, and being demoted when struggling. This dynamic system prevented students from falling permanently behind, which Bell considered the reason some children were wrongly declared incapable of learning. His approach incorporated daily assessments, peer tutoring, and individualized advancement paths that respected each student's natural learning pace. By 1792, Bell's 200 students were teaching each other, with none older than 14. The system became so effective that students mastered reading, writing, and arithmetic faster than in traditional schools. Living British officers fought to have their sons educated alongside the orphans, recognizing the superior results of this peer learning approach. Bell returned to Britain in 1796 and predicted his system would spread around the world. His prediction proved accurate. By 1811, the National Society for the Education of the Poor established all its schools on Bell's system, and by his death in 1832, over 12,000 schools across Britain and its colonies operated under the Madras model, educating hundreds of thousands of students. Despite initial enthusiasm, by mid-century, both Bell's system and a similar approach by Joseph Lancaster were being replaced by age-graded classrooms taught by adult professionals. Lancaster's system, which had successfully educated poor children in London, shared many principles with Bell's approach, but added sophisticated monitoring and reward systems. The movement toward professional teachers was championed by Horace Mann, who envisioned schools that would produce citizens motivated by public spirit rather than self-interest. Mann's standardized approach promised efficiency and consistency, but sacrificed the individualized progression and peer learning benefits that had made Bell's system so effective. This shift marked a crucial turning point in educational philosophy, prioritizing standardization over personalization, a tension that continues to shape educational reform debates today. The 42 Coding School represents a radical reimagining of education, defying conventional educational trade-offs through an innovative peer learning model. Of 20 staff supporting 1,000 students at 42 Silicon Valley, only 4 are teachers, a ratio that would seem impossible in traditional education. Students become both learners and educators, gathering around difficult problems like nacre in an oyster shell, forming spontaneous learning clusters that dissolve and reform as needs change. The assessment system operates through an ingenious CHIT mechanism. To have your project evaluated by a more advanced student, you must first grade someone less advanced, creating a self-sustaining cycle of review and reinforcement. This approach delivers multiple cognitive benefits. The constant level-appropriate challenges maintain curiosity and engagement. Teaching others strengthens both encoding and retrieval of information. And the gamified ladder-like advancement system creates intense motivation and dedication among students. Wildflower Montessori schools demonstrate the enduring relevance of century-old educational principles in modern contexts. Students work with meticulously designed materials arranged in a precise order, from left to right and bottom to top, creating an intuitive progression of difficulty. The materials themselves are self-correcting, allowing children to discover and fix their own mistakes without adult intervention. Recent scientific validation has been striking. Randomized trials in Milwaukee and Connecticut showed Montessori students significantly outperforming traditional students on both academic and social measures, with achievement gaps between income levels notably diminishing. The Wildflower Network grows through an organic mitosis model. When enrollment demand exceeds capacity, one teacher remains while another establishes a new nearby location, maintaining intimate school sizes and community connections. The MOOC revolution began dramatically when MIT's first online course in 2012 attracted 155,000 registrants, highlighting the massive global appetite for quality education. The story of Batushig Mayangenbayarl, a ninth grader from Ulaanbaatar, Mongolia, who achieved a perfect score despite English language barriers, exemplified both the potential and challenges of online learning. By 2018, the MOOC landscape had exploded to over 100 million students enrolled in 11,400 courses from more than 900 institutions worldwide. However, data revealed a concerning pattern. These platforms primarily served already educated, affluent populations rather than democratizing education for underserved communities as initially hoped. Artificial intelligence and machine learning have introduced unprecedented possibilities for personalized learning. IBM Watson Education developed sophisticated systems that break subjects into thousands of discrete instructional points, creating detailed knowledge maps and customized learning pathways for each student. In China, Squirrel AI took this approach further, decomposing middle school mathematics into 10,000 precise knowledge points. The company's founder, Derek Lee, envisions a future where human teachers transition to primarily emotional support roles, pilots who guide and encourage while AI algorithms optimize the actual instruction process. This raises profound questions about the future balance between human and artificial intelligence in education.
MIT's groundbreaking approach to expanding effective education strategically focused on higher education, where the institution could leverage its prestigious reputation to back a new online credential with the established value of a traditional MIT degree. The innovative MicroMasters program serves dual purposes, functioning as both a standalone credential for working professionals and as an alternative admissions pathway to complete a full master's degree on campus. The Supply Chain Management program, selected as the pilot initiative, demonstrated the model's potential by allowing students like Paulina Gisbrecht, a working mother from Germany, and Shridipti Kidambi, a mid-career professional from India, to balance demanding work schedules and family commitments while earning valuable credentials for just $1,000 to $1,200, a fraction of traditional tuition costs. While the MicroMasters program still maintains selective standards, it fundamentally transforms the traditional winnowing process, wasting far less human potential than conventional admission systems. Students who don't proceed to the on-campus portion still emerge with a valuable, industry-recognized credential at roughly one-fifth the cost of a traditional master's degree. The program's success has catalyzed rapid expansion to 52 programs across global institutions, including prestigious universities like Harvard, Georgia Tech, and the University of Queensland. It maintains academic rigor while prioritizing learning outcomes above all else, fostering virtual and in-person community connections through study groups, online forums, and regional meetups. The program's key innovation was discovering how to attach genuine value to educational standards while minimizing artificial barriers and exclusivity. This formula has become the foundation for MIT's expanding ecosystem of alternative learning pathways, which includes several innovative components. Free open courseware materials that serve both as educational resources and preliminary admission screening tools, intensive mid-career boot camps that efficiently compress semester-long learning into focused week-long immersions, and an emerging apprenticeship network connecting learners directly with entrepreneurs, venture capitalists, and corporate executives. The vision extends toward creating a comprehensive, modular, distributed transcript system owned by individual learners rather than institutions. This digital credential infrastructure would enable truly flexible educational experiences across multiple institutions, formats, and timeframes, allowing students to accumulate and stack credentials throughout their careers. While prestigious institutions will continue to maintain selective programs, the broader transformation means high-quality learning opportunities will become increasingly accessible to motivated learners worldwide. Contemporary workforce demands require education that balances immediate relevance with timeless principles, teaching not just technical subject matter, but also essential meta skills, creative ego for innovation, comfort with ambiguity and complexity, and working memory control for effective learning. Modern learning science provides evidence-based insights for structuring instruction to support rather than impede natural cognitive processes, from spaced repetition to active recall strategies. With careful attention to historical lessons about educational access and equity, we can finally prioritize learning over arbitrary selection and universal access over artificial scarcity. The convergence of technology, pedagogical innovation, and institutional willingness to experiment has created the conditions for a transformative new era of learning without traditional boundaries.